preparing for our opening event of the fall season. My name is Sarah Holliday, and I'm the head of events here, and I'm standing here very briefly because you really want to hear from these excellent panelists. Three quick things. First, please turn off your cell phones or silence them so that you're sure they make no noise during the presentation. We appreciate it. Second, a new thing this season, we have a little form on the table outside the room that says, what did you think of this event? Please give us your feedback. It's in no way required, but if you have any comments, positive or negative, feel free to grab one of those forms on the way out and hand it back to me or to anyone at the front desk when you're done. If you are not currently on our email list, you can also add your email on there and we'll add you to it. We have lots of great events coming up this season, and many of them are open both to members and non-members, so you're welcome to be on our mailing list whether you're a member of the library or not. Either way, you're also welcome to grab a brochure on the table there for a little more information about the library in general. Third thing, the book is for sale, courtesy of the Corner Bookstore right over here. I will be there to sell books after the event, and any of the authors you see here who have segments in the book will be happy to sign a copy. Not too early to begin thinking about holiday gifts, just saying. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks everyone for coming out. So what we're going to do first is do some readings from the book, and then we'll have a little discussion and then open it up for questions, and so that's sort of the general outline of what we're going to be doing. My name is Matt Goodwin. I'm the editor of the book here, and it's an anthology of Latino science fiction and fantasy. We have four of the writers here, which is really great. So we're going to start with Carlos. Carlos Hernandez is the author of The Assimilated Cuban's Guide to Quantum Santería, and many works of science fiction and fantasy, including poetry and drama. By day, he's a CUNY associate professor of English and has worked in game writing and game design.
So I'm going to be, hi everybody, thank you so much for coming out today. I'm just going to be reading a few pages from the story that I have included in the anthology called Entanglements. I didn't know Karen was married until her husband, Chase, was wounded in action and was coming home. An IED took both his legs at the knee. She couldn't leave him, not now. She had to break it off with me. I should have been angry, but all I felt was a vacuous shock. I had no idea how I should react. So I tried to imagine what a decent person would say in this situation and parroted that. What do you need? She didn't answer for a while. Her kitchen smelled like a Pennsylvania July. The mason jars lining the high shelf broke the morning sunlight into rainbows. Through the window, I watched the corn swaying like a crowd at a revival. I leaned against her counter, sipping orange juice. She sat at the table, double clutching her mug and letting her tears fall where they may. Chase can't have children anymore, she finally told her coffee. I will never be a mother. I thought terrible things. Among the least savage was, we were planning a family together, you and me, remember? But out loud, I said, right now, you need to focus on Chase. She looked at me, her smile full of self-loathing. Do you hate me, Jesus? No, I said automatically. You're human, you made a mistake. She laughed through her nose, no sound, just air. I don't get you. I don't get you one bit. I swirled my juice. You want me to yell and scream? I want you to feel something. Jesus, Jesus, do you know what Chase would do to me if he found out I'd been cheating on him? She was about to sip more coffee, but she stopped suddenly and yelled, aren't Spanish guys supposed to be passionate? I stopped leaning, stood straight. I dumped out the rest of my juice in the sink, washed the glass, dried it with the rag, set it also carefully in the rack. What are you doing? Karen asked. I stepped away to admire my work, made a box of my fingers like a cinematographer framing a shot. That glass was perfectly clean. Still looking at it, I said, Spanish guys come from Spain. I'm Puerto Rican. And without another word, I left.
Okay, next we have Sabrina. Sabrina Vorbulias is a freelance editor and journalist. She is the author of the novel Ink, came out in 2012. It's a novel that draws on her memories of Guatemala's internal conflict and of the Latinx experience in the United States. It was named Latinidad's Best Books of 2012.
So, I'm going to be reading my short story, which is called Seen in Bible. The protagonist is a psychologist in a survivor center for survivors of torture and also immigration trauma. Someone famous, I can't remember who, once said that when a language dies, so does memory. I wonder about that whenever Maria Jose Manrique comes to the center and sits across the desk from me. She doesn't come regularly and no longer makes the impression she once did. In the early days of her counseling, she not only wore her traditional blouse and skirt, she wound a bright 20-meter ribbon around her head in imitation of the sun. The headdress is called a tocoyal in Sotomayor, but it's been at least a decade since she's spoken it. And today, when I ask her why she doesn't wear the headpiece anymore, she refers to it by the Guatemalan Spanish word for all such ornamentation, tocado, then skillfully avoids answering my question. Tocado, in case you were wondering, also means touched. Touched has an odd set of meanings in English. Those seven letters convey the straightforward tactile, intangible compassion, and assumed mental illness or incompetence all at once. Survivors of torture, no matter how touching their testimony, are often written off as touched. Last year's genocide trial in Guatemala is a good example. The Ixil women who stood and recounted gang rapes and massacres that wiped out full villages were discredited with arguments of hysteria, of confabulation, of the childish inability to distinguish protective action from oppressive. Maria Jose and I watched some of the live stream of the trial together in my office while it was happening. My client sat dry-eyed and unmoving, even when one of the testimonies, recounted in a different indigenous language and translated into Spanish, was remarkably similar to her own story. The live stream went in and out, and each time it did, I studied La Marijo, as she's come to be known after so many years in the United States. ¿Qué buscas? She had finally asked when she noticed my scrutiny. What are you looking for? As if that wasn't a question to be answered in a lifetime instead of a 15-minute session. I guess I'm looking for a reaction, I had said. I want to know if this serves as proxy justice for you. What you've got to understand about La Marijo is that she smiles a lot. A wide rictus of a smile that you can never be sure is about something good. She hadn't answered my question that day, just smiled and smiled, and months later, after the genocide verdict was vacated, and we all understood that no one was going to be serving a sentence for crimes against humanity, her only comment was that smile. I can't remember if I smiled on the rescinded verdict day. Maybe later, at home, as I was carving a figure from an apple I had on my hand. Maybe when I bored a hole through its chest with the tip of my paring knife. Maybe every time I hear that the tough old ex-president and military man from Guatemala has started having some trouble breathing.
Okay, so now we have Coral, born in Nogales, Arizona. Coral Markham is the author of Q Lazarus and the forthcoming Camera Obscura. He was a Wallace Steigner Fellow at Stanford University. He's been a Canto Mundo Fellow and a recipient of grants from the National Endowment of the Arts, the Illinois Arts Council, and the Ragdale Foundation. He currently lives in Pittsburgh.
Good afternoon, I'm so glad to see you all here. Unlike most of the writers in the anthology, you won't be hearing any fiction from me. Matthew was kind enough to select some of his poems to be included in the anthology. This is a sequence of haikus based on deep space images, so I take the spirit of the haiku, the form itself, and this is what came out of it. Sci-fi coup. Eve of chilled stars stuns the night dark blue. Gravity holds my place, twirling. The rings of Saturn shimmer, it is said, like white sand and shells, the shore. Venus, Jupiter, dance like forlorn lovers, each bright burrow pining. Asteroids are hurtling in their field, unlucky leftovers, poor rocks. Telescopic eyes and such enormity, so little light squeaks through. Robots venture where we can't. Do servos whir where there is no sound? Earth rise. Now we see how we are seen. Enviable blue world, so small. When stars explode, they color clouds that look like crabs, even if they don't. Starship Enterprise, its continuing mission, so boldly going. Beam me up, Scotty. Damn it, Jim, I'm a doctor. Live long and prosper. Some neutron stars pulse as accurately as atomic clocks, a heartbeat. Gauzy ribbon, our own galaxy, spilled milk sky. We are but an arm. We should be a space-faring peoples, if only to leave and come back. But since poems are short, I'm going to read you two. This is called a science fiction, and it's based on several physicist theories, specifically Hawking's theory of what happens should a person pass the event horizon of a black hole, the elongation, the spaghetti theory, right? Time becomes all at once for someone like that. And so I try to use tense shifts to indicate that kind of feeling. So the speaker has just been aware that he's passed the event horizon. A science fiction. When the sun rose, it was smaller than in my dream. I had been asleep for what felt a long time, and wake, confused and claustrophobic. The texture of sky still magnetized me, a desert bright day. But the light is streaked like too much everything pulled to the edges of a window in storm. What little of me exists as aperture. I wanted so little for my birthday, a moment's peace on a hill. And where did that get me? Into the stars themselves? To hitch myself to a salvage run, 13 years round trip? A distress signal? A freighter that company had written off the summer I learned to kiss a girl until she shook with desire. When the engines fired, no one thought to think, could even know this uncharted singularity. At night, on Earth, I am all of Orion. At night on earth, I fell tangential into a puddle of cold rain and rippled the muddied reflection of light, blurred the confusion of New Chicago into circuit and solder. This is what I can expect. Gravity, density, volume dissipating. I am all at once. I studied all night for an exam I wouldn't pass, slept through a snowfall that piled itself upon itself. Death isn't the door you would expect, isn't the carriage kindly stopping. I celebrated my birthday on a science rig surveying a binary system. The galley scrounges up cake and candle. I wish myself into consciousness. Proximity alarms should be blaring, but light is stretched to sound, sound stitched to light, light solidifying in absence, absent that sequence.
Okay, now we have Richie. Born and raised in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, Richie Narvaez is the award-winning author of Roach Killer and other stories. His fiction has appeared in Grand Central Noir, Plots with Guns, Sunshine Noir, and Spine Tingler.
Thanks, Matt. And thank you all for coming. It's good to have you here. It's great to be in this wonderful room. I'm going to read a story, from the book. This is called Room for Rent. Hala stood in the black rain outside the landlord's door. Cold, sooty water soaked her tunic, but he did not invite her in. Behind the landlord was a cramped, filthy room, but it radiated warmth and the smell of food. She had come to ask about the room for rent. I would like to see the room before I make a decision, if that is possible, Hala said. Can you show it to me, please? It's on the third floor. Do I look like I'm making it up there today? Indeed, to Hala, it did not. Then may I have the key to go see it myself? I don't hand over key without 3 months rent, 3 months security, paid up front. But I need to see if it is appropriate, if it's a good room. It's a room with a door, a floor, or walls, okay? I don't have time to bargain with every pava that comes by. You want the room or not? Yes, we need it. The landlord extended a moist, gray-green flipper. Hala dropped all the money she had in the world into it. Oh yeah, the landlord said. And you gotta evict the current tenant. But I understood the room was vacant. What's vacant anymore? But don't worry, it's just vermin. Is it sentient vermin? An animal? What's not sentient anymore? Hala and her mate Sangano had been living at the terminal since their arrival. It was filthy, overcrowded. She would be giving birth soon, and she wanted a clean home for all the children. This was the cheapest unit she had found, and now she knew why. May I see how infested it is first? Go right ahead, but I got your money in my hand, and it's gonna stay. The landlord was gangri, invertebrate, covered in viscous slime. A large crack ran down his dirty, heavily patched up shell. He ran a shabby building in the poorest part of the territory, but he was still gangri. It was not her place to argue with him. Hey, the landlord said, you could always eat the vermin. I know you people eat anything, even each other. He laughed to himself, his enormous, moist belly jiggling. That is a lie, Hala said, blurting it out, forgetting her place. The landlord gave her a long look. Careful now, he said. You don't want me to call the law. He threw the key at her, third floor in the back. One of his eye stems turned to show the direction. Enjoy your new home. She could still hear his laughter after he closed the door. The narrow stairs creaked under her great weight. She was heavy with the children inside her. Her belly glowed hot when they were hungry, and they were hungry now. The hallway was filled with a vile, cloying smell, almost worse than the terminal. She clumsily held the key, and as soon as she opened the door, she heard them. The vermin. They scurried into corners behind boxes and what seemed to be furniture and bedding. They sounded large. The apartment itself had a low ceiling. Hala had to bend down to enter. There was a small area that radiated heat and a tiny cold room with a circle of water in a container. The windows were dark with dirt, which was perfect. It would be a good place. And just then, one of the vermin crawled out from behind the box. It stood. As she had feared, it was a human. It had a frail pink-gray body, about half her height. Standing on just two thin appendages, it had long hair on what must have been its face. It screeched at her. Hala clicked back, but clearly it did not understand. She opened the door and used her pincers to indicate that she wanted it to leave. The human shook its head. Then others came out. There were about a dozen of them, different sizes, different colors. Clearly, an infestation. She pointed again to the open door. The human, who seemed to be their leader, hopped up and down with its lower appendages and then crossed its upper appendages across its torso. Hala understood that. This was not going to be easy. Sangamo would tell her to hire an exterminator, but they had no money for that. She would have to get a translator. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So what I wanted to do was kind of ask a couple of questions to kind of have a little bit of a discussion and then open it to questions. So the first, I guess there's kind of two entryways into thinking about genre. So what is the expressive power of genre? Like, what do we get from it? Like, what are the virtues of mystery or horror or science fiction or fantasy? What do we gain? What do you think you gain from it as a writer? That's one question. And then that's the thing about genre. Genres have a history. That it's what makes them unique. And so whenever we engage a genre, we're engaging the history, you know, whether we like it or not. And many writers are directly kind of like challenging the tradition and rejecting it. Some are kind of trying to like fulfill it or take a personal take on it. So how do you see your writing in terms of the history of the genre that you're working in, or something like that? So maybe keep those two questions, and I'll talk a little bit about the book in terms of these questions. So when I started studying Latino literature, I realized that a lot of the experiences that I was seeing in the community were not being represented in the literature. And that I realized that science fiction and fantasy and other genres were in some ways better at expressing the extreme scenarios of like being, you know, fearing deportation, you know, extreme poverty, and so these getting through the immigration legal system, which is very like Kafkaesque, and you can like only science fiction can make sense of that world. So I started to look at writers who were going down that path, the basic idea is that in science fiction, in particular, you don't just have metaphors. Like in traditional fiction, you'll have a metaphor, like going to New York from Puerto Rico is like going to the moon, you know, which is a common metaphor. But in science fiction, you can actually make that happen, and it's no longer a metaphor, it's concrete, and you have characters actually have to deal with that. And so the kind of extremity of going to another place can be expressed through that genre. There's a movie maybe some of you know, Sleep Dealer. It's about a Mexican worker who is in Mexico, and he has virtual reality goggles, and he works in the United States using virtual reality goggles. So it's using a very common science fiction-like image and using it to express the experience of being in two places at once, or being bilingual. And science fiction has a great value if you're trying to depict these extreme experiences and you know, experiences of dislocation, basically. And then I guess I would say, in terms of the history, science fiction classically is deeply intertwined with colonialism. All of the early works of science fiction were born in that context. And even now, the majority of the films that come out that are like science fiction relate directly to it. Avatar and District 9 and these films. Science fiction has, from the beginning, been immersed in colonialism and that the language of colonialism. So, you know, I've seen that a lot of writers now, black writers and Latino writers, are trying to push a little bit against that. And it's changing the field. It's changing the genre, which I think is kind of amazing. So that's a little bit about how I see, like, where the book is situated. So maybe we can just go down and just kind of see what you can answer here.
Yeah, so I mean, I'd say a couple of things to that. I think the question of genre takes a little thinking about, because, you know, I'm a college professor too, and I've done a lot of thinking about the ways in which we taxonomize literature, and to me, there's no such thing of writing without genre. There's no such thing as sort of like a literary genre that is free of any kind of assumptions. I think the vast majority of what we call literary fiction falls squarely in the genre of domestic realism, for instance. You know, and so, you know, what a novel, let's say, start that, or a story does at its inception is tell you a little bit about the assumptions that it's making about the world and asking you to buy into them. And this is why I think science fiction is particularly useful to people who are writing about these kinds of issues that we're writing about here, because it allows us to come in sideways and lightly. And that light step allows us to enter into a conversation that might have been heretofore prohibited to certain people. And so I think, you know, one of the things that happens in this, I'm very glad that you got the little joke that I put in there, the Jesus Jesus, you know, like that little moment. But that to me was an important little joke to put in there, because it sets up the dichotomy of, you know, somebody who is speaking very good English and is in a relationship, you know, here in the middle of Pennsylvania, and who has this name Jesus, and those kinds of frisions then are the ones that are going to build on. The part that I read, I think, could have been, you know, very much in a literary story. It goes science fiction a little bit later, you know, but where we start there is very different than, say, Ritchie's, you know, story that, you know, hits us head on with a very fantastical kind of beginning. And so I guess what I would say is, you know, I think we have to be careful when we talk about genre and not make an assumption that genre is sort of like, oh, you know, that fiction that does all these things, but then the literary writers are doing something else. It's all genre, I think. So that's where I would start the conversation.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Guatemala, and I grew up reading Tolkien and C.S. Lewis at the same time as I was reading Miguel Ángel Asturias and Ernesto Sabato and markets. And to be honest with you, I'm very hard to categorize in terms of my writing. I've been told I'm too literary to be genre and too genre to be literary. and I'm delighted to be hopping borders all over the place. I don't believe in them. You know, I think that I started really writing poetry, jumped into journalism, and then very late in life, when I was turning 50, I published my first sci-fi story, fantasy story. For me, all of those different forms really inform where I'm going, and I think the genre, whether it's the leaps that poetry enables you to take, or the magic that shows up even in my science fantasy, or more science fiction books, I can't conceive of a world where magic doesn't exist because I see it. And it's one of the great things about being a journalist is that you get to witness magic happening and write about it. So, you know, for me, I feel like I'm within certainly a Latin American tradition that marries journalism and genre fiction. I mean, Gabriel Garcia Marquez is a perfect example of somebody who was deeply, deeply engaged in journalism and at the same time writing fiction that was, you know, magical and fantastical. So I see myself sort of part of that, and part of also the more North American school of that, people like Charles de Lint, who create very consciously magical realist worlds from a Canadian vernacular and so forth. So I'm kind of a mixed bag and genre hopper and border hopper, and that's it.
Well, you don't get much more mixed genre than what you had heard from me. I think genres are about, in some sense, convention and both fulfilling and denying those conventions as you explore whatever it is you're exploring in a piece of work. While I use the dramatic monologue in that poem, Science Fiction, and use some of the tropes of science fiction, what it comes down to is it's a story about being unraveled, right, by forces beyond you. And I think that that is something that's very common to all of us. We've all been in a situation where, beyond any of our control, everything is going to hell. And here we are able to use those conventions and go fulfill them and turn them on their head. For example, I take the entire idea of science fiction and drop it into this dramatic monologue that's roughly in a blank verse. Play around with that a little bit too, but that's part of the fun of writing that way. And for example, with the haiku, right, taking those ideas of traditional haikus, both in their form and in their focus on the natural world, and just turning that gaze upward a little bit, I find freeing. So it's fun to play with genre and both utilize some of the things that your audience expects to see, and at the same time give them something they perhaps don't expect.
Actually, going back to what Carlos was saying, the idea of a domestic fiction. When I was young and full of beans, and when I just got out of college, I wanted to be a great literary writer. I sent many stories to the New Yorker, got some nice rejections. One personalized, and I still hold on to that. But that was my dream. I was going to be a great literary writer, and I was getting some stuff published. But then I was trying to, and I think it was a good evolution of myself, trying to get at some things that were more and more personal. And I was born and raised in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And I was still living there after college. I went back. And if you know Williamsburg 70, in the 1970s, 1980s, when I was growing up, vastly different area. And I was still there when it started undergoing a massive change. and I really wanted to write about that change. And I tried to go at it directly, with a literary domestic fiction novel, and it invaded me because it was too close. It was too personal. I was too angry to get to it. When I finally was able to embrace genre, which took a while, when I was a child, I ate too much Robert E. Howard, like far too much. Raymond Chandler, I was ingesting Edgar Rice Burroughs like crazy. I love genre, but I resisted it when I was, you know, English major, now I was gonna write literary fiction. But when I was able to resolve that with myself, which took a few years, resolve that within myself, I said I was writing crime fiction stories. I do mostly crime fiction, though I also do science fiction and horror. And I saw that there was a way to get to what I was trying to say indirectly, and to express a lot of my anger using violence and using crime, but using that format, using genre, metaphorically, allegorically, in all these different ways, and it really helped me to express something that I couldn't express using just regular literary fiction. So for that, it was sort of empowering that way.
And just to pick up on that, something that you said, Matt, you know, the power of metaphor is the one that we often attribute to what we call high literary fiction, the simile. But, you know, the allegory was the way that we approached literature for hundreds and hundreds of years, and science fiction is much better at allegory. Fantasy is much better at allegory. And that kind of representation is finding, I think, its strongest root right now in science fiction, fantasy, and in the genres, and horror too, you know, because horror, I would say, so there's this guy named Svenja Todorov who talks about the fantastic, and if you think about the fantastic writ large, it would include things like science fiction, fantasy, and horror in this big Venn diagram. And I would say that, you know, that allegorical way of seeing the world is one of the ways that I think has been lost a little bit through the cult of realism. And I think realism itself has dominated since Guy de Maupassant, I think, you know, mm-hmm. was writing, you know, and that sort of like trend toward realism, and it has impoverished, I think, literary writing for a long time. And I think once we started seeing Jules Verne and H.G. Wells being very popular with their writing, then we had two different poles for a different kind of axis into writing.
And I think that's very interesting to talk about allegory, right? Think about allegory, just speak other than you mean, and the rise of literary fiction questions the validity of speaking other than you mean. It's
right. Well, and it has to do with the literalization of action. So, you know, we should go to the moon, you know, in a literary book is a very different thing than we should go to the moon in a science fiction book, where it's like, okay, how about next Tuesday? You know, it's very practical and kind of possible.
At the same time, I think some of the stuff that's really intriguing people like me are really to new genre with what has really, you know, been considered a more literary concern. So, like, for example, the story I read a portion from today is really concerned with language. It's full of, it talks really about translation because it's full of homographs. In English and Spanish, words that look exactly the same and mean vastly different things. And sort of the idea of, you know, holding two realities, two linguistic realities at once, which to me is very much sort of the experience of the bicultural person in the United States, holding two experiences at the same time. But this sort of formalism we associate more directly with literary endeavor than with genre endeavor, and I keep saying, you know, I mean, the classic question, well, why not? You know, why can't it also, at the same time as, you know, as fantastical stuff happens, examine issues that are more formal?
So just to pick up on that quickly, I just reread with my fiance The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. We read it out loud to each other. And that is a realist book, that is a fantasy book. You know, really it's just the metaphors and the conceits are so entangled that it's so much a life of the mind, it's so much an act of language that it is fantasy in every way except that everything could happen. You know, and so it's one of these books that I think really beautifully bridges the gap between anything that we would say is fantastical and anything that we would say is the real, because what it does, it shows us that the real is often bound to the way in which we can conceive the real through language. And then we're talking about the bi culture and especially the bilingual. You know, I think if you ever want to have, you know, just like 2 minutes of fun, translate an old adage in English into Spanish or vice versa, and all of a sudden these things become surreal and usually awful and horrendous, you know, war crime-ish kind of things that you can do, you know, because we live in these metaphors so deeply that we forget that they're false, they're invented, and that they're comparisons that don't exist outside of the culture.
Take a question?
Yeah.
Okay. Does anybody have a
You write in both English and Spanish.
Si, señor.
And I thought of Gertrude Stein saying once upon a time that she never learned French because then it would ruin her English. And I'm wondering whether she was using it, we won't know, she was using it as an excuse because she didn't have a talent.
Pues yo crecí hablando español e inglés además. And that I think has always put me in a kind of place where I inhabit two worlds at the same time, because of something that you were speaking about, both linguistically and culturally. I have the great advantage of being able to walk around in the unmarked body. But I'm always conscious of that unmarkedness. I very seldom am approached or confused as being a Mexican-American unless I'm back home in Tucson, where there are lots of kids that look like me, because now I'm half white and half Mexican-American. And so the way it's influenced me, I think, has been the ability to inhabit uncertainty, both linguistically and with regard to just being in the world. Me ha dado un idioma para expresar las cosas que no se pueden expresar en la otra idioma, and vice versa.
You sometimes, in my experience, whatever it is that I'm writing, it could be just a text message or something bigger. Sometimes I lean on one word that I can think of in Spanish, and then I go back to think of it. Either I think about it myself, or I look it up in the dictionary, but I find it like I'm leaning on one or the other of the languages I speak.
Sometimes it's about the moment of inspiration for me. And then sometimes it's about practicality. Sometimes when I think of practicality, I think of the old dicho that my grandmother used to say to me, el hombre prevenido vale por dos. And I really took that to heart. I'm like, okay, so you plan and you think and you wonder about possible outcomes and then plan for any that you can foresee, and that will make your life easier. And that's the kind of practical way, I think, that I lean on something culturally and linguistically. And then from an artistic standpoint, I do see that idea of the word. For example, the word igualmente, of the same mind, is a kind of direct translation. But that doesn't necessarily capture what we mean when we say igualmente, right? And I thought about that word, igualmente, and just the way that it shows this the same-mindedness and this familiarity. And I, you know, I've written a poem about that kind of sense, that igualmente was the inspiration for writing the piece. There's another piece that my new manuscript that looks at Hubble images, ekphrastically, the way poets have often looked at paintings. So I'm looking at Hubble images that way. And there's a very famous image of the Helix Nebula, which they call the Eye of God Nebula. It was on the cover of Time magazine. And it looks like an eye, a really really looks like an iris. But when I approach it, I had to call it Ojo de Dios. And so that's the subtitle of that poem in this sequence. And there is some English and Spanish in it.
Okay.
Okay.
First of all, I also grew up in Williamsburg, so I understand it. I think I grew up at the same time there, so. I believe.
What street?
Manhattan Avenue.
Manhattan Avenue? Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, I was at South 17th. Oh. Okay. Junior high school 15?
No.
Oh, okay.
Mostly here.
Oh, okay.
First of all, I do believe Carl mentioned something about the expectation of writers, not the writers, of the readers.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just thinking, again, if I can answer this, about as Latino writers, do we feel almost a pressure of the expectation, because we're Latino writers, to kind of bring a flavor of our background?
Absolutely.
Our
absolutely.
Oh, yeah. So I was wondering if we can kind of touch on that a little bit. How do we address that as a writer? Either do we have, sometimes we feel like we have to do something to show our Latino-ness, or maybe we just feel like, hey, I'm just going to write.
Mm-hmm.
And if it comes out, it comes out.
I would agree with the last sentiment that you have, that I'm just going to write it and it comes out, and it's Latino because it's a Latino writer. But then you think about audience, and then you think about expectations of audience. And audience is, I think, one of the things that when I used to teach, I used to put up the Aristotelian triangle of audience, right, where you have the speaker or writer, and then over on this side you have the constituency, the community from which that writer comes. And then anyone who engages with that, right, no matter where they come from, and within that triangle, that comprises the idea of audience. And so it makes you think about the idea of expectation. Your community might have a certain expectation of reading your work since they know you. And then people who come to your work blindly also would seem to have some kind of expectation. And for, I think, many years, and I think this is true in African-American literature, I think this is true in Asian-American literature, there is a pressure by the publishing to have some kind of cultural representation of the work that they see. And I don't think that that's necessarily useful or good or true. But I think when we write as Latinos, it arises naturally. And when it does, it does. And when it doesn't, ni modo. Right? I don't think there's a single word of Spanish in the two pieces I wrote. But that doesn't mean they're not Latino literature.
I also think it really depends on sort of the ámbito that you're in when you're writing. I was for many years the editor of a Spanish language newspaper. And so I was very used to being in a newsroom with people who spoke both English and Spanish and wrote both English and Spanish all the time.
Yes.
And switched off, and who were all also Latinos and enmeshed really in sort of the issues of the Latino community in Philadelphia. So, you know, so I wrote for where I was, and where I was hopped between languages, you know, sometimes from one sentence to the next. And much of it was really, absolutely mired or centered in where I was living and what I was doing. Now, I will say that I think, for example, there are some expectations. I have been able to sell the stories that are set in urban places far more readily than I have been able to sell stories of Latinos in rural places, which is, you know, where I live in outside of Philadelphia. I live in a rural area that has big Latino enclaves, mushroom farmers in one end of the county, and the remnants of steel workers and industrial workers on the other end. But that's not how publishers very often have the expectation that if you are a US Latino or Latina or Latinx, Particularly if you're East Coast, you're absolutely going to be writing urban stories. We disappear from landscapes that aren't urban. And I think, you know, those are things that we as Latinos push against. But you may see more of our work that sells that is set in urban enclaves.
Yeah, and coming from in the Southwest, there's a pressure of writing about the border. Are you going to write about the border since you, you know, I was literally born maybe 30 feet from the border. And one of the things when I published my first book, that shall remain nameless. I was asked to change the title from Q Lazarus, that's a beautifully evocative title, to would you like to change this to The Faded Hills of a Border? And I said, you want me to brown it up a little bit for you? No, this is what it's called. The fact that I had to fight for that title, I think tells us something about publishing and expectation for Latino writing.
Yeah, I think what I would add to that, just picking up on that, is that every time a Latino, Latina is asked to write, you are the representative of your culture. You are the apotheosis of all of the multicultural suffering, and you must, in your story, you know, reveal all of that. Well, but for everybody else, it's very difficult. You know? And my story, by the way, takes place in a Pennsylvania cornfield for a long time. Bringing the rural here. But yeah, it's just, Latinos write novels of ideas, you know? Latinos write goofy, you know, light fiction, you know? Latinos write all sorts of things, and that's one of the things that's very hard to pull off when you're constantly being expected to be, you know, sort of like the speaker for your people, you know? And I think it is a way, very well-intentioned, that can be a little dehumanizing. You know, it's like because you're asked to fulfill a role rather than express the power of your art.
And at the same time, I think it's really, really important that, I know there are a lot of people who don't want to be categorized as Chicano writers, Latino writers, whatever. I really emphasize that. Obviously, I don't have a name that you automatically assume I'm Latina, but I do it because I have had a number of young people come up to me at readings and say, you know, you're the first Latina who has come to read at this particular place or so forth. And I think it's really important to be visible. So on the one hand, it's, you know, there's a burden in trying to, you know, write for nuestra gente, right, and be representative and be everything to everybody, which none of us can be, and at the same time, we really have to be visible, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I would definitely second that. And, I mean, I remember the first time I read a poem by another writer of color that made me see myself in the world as well. The first time I picked up Emplumada by Lorna Isurba. It's the first time I opened a book of poetry and went, here I recognize myself, here I recognize my mother, my sister, my family. And it was at that point that I realized that, as you know, at 19 you're writing poetry for generally one reason, and that's to get laid. And that it was a kind of turning point for me, right? It opened a door to the muse of culture that I didn't think was possible to me because I hadn't seen it. And then as I saw that, I was able to find it again. I was able to find, you know, Gary Soto, and then go back from there. And to pick up on the idea of representation, that's so, I think, important for me. I've never hidden my Latino heritage at all. Right? In some ways, I'm hidden from my Latino heritage. But if it comes up, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm Mexican. Oh, you didn't know that? That's okay. Because we come in all different flavors. And going back to the publishing thing, that's the main reason for my new title and my new manuscript. I'm going full Latin on this one, A Camera Obscura.
And you get to be a stealth Hispanic, stealth Latino with your name. With my name, Narvaez, it automatically comes with a sense of otherness. So I do feel sort of
pressured into doing other stories, other this story stuff with Puerto Rican characters. But every once in a while, I have to tell you, I want to knock off a flash fiction piece, usually in horror, it turns out. Then, you know, why should, I don't necessarily want to make the characters Hispanic or Latino or Puerto Rican, I just want to have characters. But I do feel the pressure, like, oh, maybe I should call him Jose, you know, I'm just going to call him Joe, because it's like, well, I'm a Latino writer, I guess I should always use Latino characters. But sometimes I just want to just write the story and let the story tell itself. And there's like a little bit, putting in the Latino-ness, the ethnic background, is it taking it away from what I want the story to be? And with a flash fiction piece, it's very concentrated storytelling. And I'm automatic, to put that in, maybe taking the story in a direction that I don't want it to tell. Sometimes it's great because it gives it another reflection. But sometimes I just want to tell the story. But I always do feel the pressure. And to make it urban as well. Mm-hmm. And it happens a lot with mystery fiction as well. I've been finding, and weirdly enough, when I write mystery fiction, sometimes I will have no Latino characters. Those will not get published as much as the ones where I put Latino characters in. Those get accepted in more. And I think it's because, well, if you're Latino, well, that's what we want from you.
Yeah.
You know, and they'll want, like, the diverse guy for the issue. I'm the quota for the issue, so you should write within your wheelhouse because that's then we have diversity, that kind of thing.
You have another question?
I'm wondering, you say the genocidio or the genocide, or you don't specify the language of the country. Where do you? Does it matter? I do actually earlier, you know, that it's Guatemala. So I figured, but I didn't want to jump to the conclusion because you didn't mention it. Since my early adulthood, Guatemala has been a mess, to say it very prosaically, but it's a horror story. And I'm wondering if you think of something in particular or what, you know, starting in, let's say, arbitrarily 57 on to the current times. It's been, do you know of any time where you would not have thought of it as genocide? Are you thinking about it in terms of the last half century or not?
Well, you know, there really was a genocide trial. And it was brought by a very specific group of indígenas in Guatemala. I mean, there are others who also have claimed a genocide, but essentially within the whole 36 years of governmental armed internal conflict, there are years, like a decade essentially, in which the Ixchi in particular, members of whom brought or testified in the genocide trial of Rio Montt, they essentially make the argument, and I agree with them, but clearly, you know, plenty of people in Guatemala who have ties to different dictators and so forth don't agree. They make the claim that there was a targeted effort to eliminate them, to eliminate their way of being, their traditions. And so it goes beyond simply a dirty war, which the rest of the 36 years are, and an effort to essentially displace them, eliminate them, take them away from everything that makes them Ixchis. You know, so it actually is a real bone of contention. Their hashtags, si fue genocidio, yes it was, or no fue genocidio. You know, so this is something that is continuing in Guatemala. And I think one of the things that happens when you're a writer who has come from a country that shaped you, but you haven't been there in years and years and years, is that you kind of get stuck in that vocabulary in that time frame. And if I look at the output of my short stories, there are a lot that are informed by you know, what happened during that 36-year conflict in Guatemala. And a lot of it, and that's like a trauma I revisit, even though it's not a direct trauma, it's a trauma of childhood, and it's no longer necessarily what people think of in Guatemala, except in instances when people come up for trial. But what I like to do is then bring other aspects. So like at the time I wrote Sin Embargo, we were seeing all of the children and families from the Northern Triangle, including Guatemala, at the border, and essentially fleeing violence of a slightly different, of a less obviously political sort, but still informed by the years of genocide. So I think if you are enamored of a country or tied to a country with that sort of history, it's very hard to step away from it altogether and not see it and want to revisit it in your work. Or at least it is for me. Or maybe I'm very obsessive about things. I don't know.
Somebody else? Question?
Yeah. I wanted to touch on a couple of points that you said. You know, I'm a very American girl. Right. I'm black and I'm very American, which differentiates me from Canadian citizens. A lot of little blacks who basically dominate the face of black America today. The school's one nightmare, so of all people had one week in Springsteen. Yes. And that led me to the Poetry Project, where I met a lot of people, including Allen Ginsberg and lots of others. And so I always wrote a lot long before I met them. And then I think the first foreign book I read was French. I can't stand French. French. And she was like 16 and she wrote this legendary memoir, which is still legendary. I forget her name. She died like in the 90s. And I loved this book. And it was French. And the French love to be French. But I identified with this book because she touched on something. She was a teenage girl, she was writing about her life, and she was going through teenage trauma. The same. Then I read Unforgettable Likeness of Being. I've always loved this book. There was a bisexuality thing going on in there. I loved it. That he was Czech or whatever he was, and it was that, and he wasn't needing that, but I identified with that. Then I read The Kiss of the Spider. Which had nothing to do with a bunch of gay guys, but I identified with the prison thing because I knew a lot of people in the East Village. So I think no matter who you are, where you live, if you really write something genuine that is human, it will come across to anybody. And I think very few people do that. They're too busy pleasing the publisher. Which I don't think any of these three writers did when they wrote these books. Also, horror stories are the best place for a political agenda. I remember Harry Belafonte has a daughter. They came out, she came, she's an actress, very beautiful, Harry Belafonte's daughter. And she came out with this movie, she's biracial, she came out with this movie in the 80s. And it was horrible. She was married to a white guy, and the next door neighbor was gay, and all this stuff was going on, which they would have never made a drama, but it was a great movie, and it was a horror movie, but it also was made like a real movie. And one of the principles, I had to run around with the actors, the studios also, so I learned how to make movies, is that you have to identify with the character. If you don't care about the character, you won't want to watch the movie. So we cared about the fact that she was married to this guy and all this other stuff, and we were really looking at a drama with a horror face, you know. And it was great, and there's a lot of movies like that. I think we're living sci-fi, the Jetsons, we're living suggestions with the iPhone and everything is becoming very real. And even American literature, when I went to school to study, you had to read Byron, Shelley, and Keats. I don't care if you went to the biggest school in the ghetto. You had to read that in American literature. Now, no one knows who Byron, Shelley, and Keats are. But they were, Shelley loved his wife, and he brought her everywhere, and the other guys hated women, you know? And they were trapped in a storm somewhere, and they decided to have a contest, because it was horror, and who cares about horror? So they let her participate, and of course she won. She wrote the best one, which was Frankenstein. And she's also gonna outlive them in flame, because you ask anybody walking down the street about Frankenstein, they'll know who that is, but they won't know who Byron, Shelley, and Keats.
did you want to ask him about horror?
I want to ask what book outside of Latina culture did you read as a teenager that stayed with you? It could even be a movie, an American movie.
No, that's easy for me. I remember reading T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, not because it was some great modernist, beautiful masterpiece, but because I was really into post-apocalyptic stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, ooh, The Wasteland was probably post-apocalyptic. It must have been around 16. And I read it, and first time I didn't understand it. And I'm like, okay, it's a poem. I'll probably have to read it again. And then it started to open up, right? The ideas of association was what started attracting me to the genre of poetry initially was the ability of language to make the kind of intellectual leaps that you don't get from playing a role-playing game with some dice. That there was a greater world out there that it was inhabited by language that was open to anyone with the ability to read and the ability to write, and that just drew me in. So that was the first time I really came across a piece of literature that. The second one, again, I just stumbled through the early part of learning about poetry. It was probably a poem that I read in a college class, Skunk Hour, by Robert Lowell, who died somewhere just right around here, off of the park.
In a taxi, at the
street where his lover was. But I remember reading Skunk Hour and seeing that speaker, right, struggling with all he was struggling with, right, both internally and externally in that moment, and just seeing something, as you said, completely and totally and utterly human, right? It didn't matter that I was Mexican-American and that he was, a Boston Brahmin. What mattered was the legitimacy and reality and beauty of the experience put forward in language.
For years would reread The Lord of the Rings. It was my best friend. And it took my younger brother to tell me, oh my God, you're such a nerd. But he also reread it.
I was 15 when I read The Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. And I absolutely still sentimentally look back. I think it's number 11 or 12, where he talks about the beauty of the foam coming out of a boar's mouth as it's going to attack you, and feeling to myself, this man understands me. This is a person who's like, yes, there is beauty even in the awfulest things. And so, I have a PhD in English literature. I've spent most of my life, until I reclaimed the Latinidad, reading stuff that wasn't Latino. And I read a ton of science fiction and fantasy, and almost all of them. So it's like, when you put to the question, what outside of Latino experience did you read, it's like, well, that's almost the whole culture, I had to go searching hard to find things that had at least, the suisson of the Latino culture that I remembered. And I remember, I encountered Garcia Marquez very late in life, I was already in my late 20s. And when I read A Very Old Man with Enormous Wings in English, first, I was like, this sounds exactly like the parties that my parents would throw. Like, this sounds like the kind of story that you would hear somebody tell around other, you know, like that had been cooking all day. And that was like the later revelation. So I guess, you know, I'm going to guess that many of us have read so much in English that wasn't Latino that it's part of the Latino culture here in the United States anywhere, way not to have read a ton of Latino literature.
Yeah, it's different growing up outside of the States. Yeah. You know, it was really, I was reading in both languages, and yeah, you know, I mean, part of why I write very political, fantastical work is because, you know, we were studying El Señor Presidente for Miguel Ángel Asturias. We were, you know, we were studying all of the writers who really sort of married fantastical and political. And so in a way, I have a really different experience of it because for me, they were really, they were equal yeah. time and equally part of who, you know.
Yeah, as you said, Carlos, we had to
yeah.
Yeah. For me, I was consuming comic books.
So crazy.
I was with Justice League, the Hulk a lot, which is about the ultimate other. I mean, this guy is like not accepted by anybody. I didn't realize at that point that the Incredible Hulk was about somebody who's, you know, how that meant politically or emotionally, but that appealed to me. So I was just a comic book geek. I was Lord of the Rings, all that kind of stuff. And it wasn't until, not until I read maybe Carlito's Way that I realized, oh, Latino people do this. So it was something that, you know, I had to come to, in terms of crime fiction, that they did this kind of stuff. You know, a lot of crime stuff I was reading. I think that the something outside my culture, besides comic books, that really appealed to me, there's a mystery book called Friends of Eddie Coyle that came out in the 70s. They made a great movie with Robert Mitchum. And it's such a minimalist book. I mean, it's just almost all dialogue. But it's dripping with desperation. And you really feel like you're in the mind of a petty criminal. And it ends badly, and I love stories that end badly, that noir kind of thing. And that really sold me on the fact that this kind of, that writing could have some sort of emotional power. Everything else was sort of escapism. But this was something, I mean, it's pure, you know, criminal underworld kind of thing. But it really appealed to me. And I mean, and it's one of the reasons I write so much crime fiction.
Kind of running out of time, so we certainly will answer any other questions you have if you want to come up. And the book is for sale.
We have one more question.
Oh yeah,
I can take one.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. It was amazing. I'm working on my thesis on that book and it's in narratives and translation. So I really enjoyed it. I wanted to ask about these. Like science fiction and fantasy and horror have been demeaned in Latin American literature, and mostly because of magic realism. Mm-hmm. There's always this opacity with magic realism. So what is this generation of authors bringing to the table? What is the new, or why is this awareness of science fiction now, of this recognition of science fiction? Is that a copy? Is that the influence? Is that this very powerful generation that has grown in the United States?
We were talking about this yesterday, that the fact that science fiction and the whole nerdiness thing, that in the 70s and the 80s you were ostracized for being nerdy, for being a comic bookie, suddenly in the last 10 years, certainly in the United States, it's totally okay. And that's a function of the fact that I think possibly special effects in movies were able to allow all these movies that in the 70s were horrible, were now incredible. And then the Hollywood discovered they were money makers, and then the whole engine of the culture, American culture, comes in, and it's okay to love this kind of stuff. Because, I mean, that's almost all we get to see in the movie theaters anymore, and now it's in our TVs. So now it's totally okay to be geeky and nerdy. And look at cosplay, people, this is a whole new subculture that's gigantic. Before it was just like, oh, those people are really weird that dress up. But now it's totally accepted and something, if you don't do it at a convention, it's weird. So I think it's now extremely popular. And the thing is, we're doing Latino
science fiction and fantasy. And we're hoping that it's not so much that we're like, oh, this these people are good, they're Latinos. We're just hoping that it's added to the mix of stuff, and it's not just like a weird exception or something bizarre that happens on the side.
They accepted the Japanese. They love them.
Yeah.
Well, I think Juno Diaz made it okay to be Latino and nerdy. You know, and to be, you know, to get a Pulitzer Award. And I think for I've seen a lot more Latinos writers who are just at the stage where they're emerging, sort of grappling with saying, okay, yeah, let me try speculative. This isn't something necessarily that I immediately gravitated to, but let me see what that enables me to do. And she would hate it if she heard me repeating this, because she doesn't actually like this story. But I have a friend who has written you know, a lot of non-speculative work that Anna Beth wrote a series, what became a series of Cholos combating an alien invasion. Her name is Gina Ruiz. And some of these stories are really fine, fine stories. They're all centered around Cholo culture in LA. But, you know, she's still, you know, she's writing all these stories, and, you know, some of her Cholos are in space, and this and that and the other, and she still hesitates to call herself a speculative writer. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, some of that, we're growing out of the sort of the limitations that we think or have been told speculative fiction sort of imposes on us. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say one thing, and like in Mexico and in the Caribbean, it's kind of the reverse, mm-hmm. where like science fiction is like the high like literary. it's a strange little reversal, and that's with like the U.S. global media system. That's changing a little bit. It's, you know, science fiction is coming down from its heights in Latin America. Very different relationship to science fiction in Latin America and Caribbean.
Just, I wanted to bring it back to your idea of the colonial, though, too, because I think, you know, right now, you know, with the popularity of geekdom, we're having this kind of like capitalist insurgence inside of, you know, of science fiction and fantasy and speculation that I think, you know, wouldn't be hurt by having a magical realist political sort of like reevaluation help to, you know, maybe curtail some of its excesses. You know, like The Big Bang Theory, I think, is a good example of a show that is using sort of like the geek chic model to put on week after week a pretty misogynist show. You know, a show that's pretty damned misogynist, like in terms of like the jokes that they tell and the creepy behavior of the gentlemen. So, you know, to me, I think there's maybe a time to think about, you know, as science fiction, fantasy, speculation grows in popularity, the problems that it's going to bring, that the popularity in American culture means a sort of like capitalist infusion that we should maybe take a second look at.
Mm-hmm.
This is not literature, but it is. I've been attending lectures at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and there is a real push to be inclusive and include all American art, particularly in North America, including Mexico and indigenous Native American art. And this is somewhat new, and it's not just the Met, it's in other museums across the country. There's finally a sensitivity and an awakening to Mexican art as being American art. And it's just, I love it that you're talking about what you're talking about. And maybe there's this finally an awareness, an awakening awareness of being American.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is one of the things that, having worked with a lot of Latinos who come from Mexico or Colombia or whatever, is this one of the recurring motifs, and I remember when I was in Guatemala, I thought it as well, is that, you know, everybody from North and South America considers themselves Americans. Mm-hmm. They call themselves Americans. There is a real tension with the fact that in the U.S., U.S. folks only consider themselves American. And this is something I think that we're going to have to grapple with a lot more here, because I think, you know, it is an enduring part of you know, sort of how Latin America and Canada as well sort of, you know, see us as having essentially appropriated the continent for us, just to describe us. The other, you know, we're like 300 and some million, right, people or whatever, and the other 600 million people don't get to be Americans, you know. And I think it's something that we're doing better now, I think, noticing, seeing that we're part of this sort of this continental shared traditions over the border with Mexico and shared and lots of shared history. But I think we have to do even better than that.
Mm-hmm. Be a round of applause.